Interested in the forces shaping our world? The Council on Foreign Relations has you covered. For those who like to look ahead, dive into The World Next Week, hosted by Bob McMahon and Carla Ann Robbins.
We were not forecasting anything about Russian domestic upheaval, and yet that has been the story of the week.
These were scorpions going after each other in a bottle.
And for those who want to go beyond the headlines, join Jim Lindsay as he opens up the president's inbox.
What should U.S. policy do?
The approach towards China, it's enough to make me question bipartisanship.
And finally, join me, Gabrielle Sierra, on Why It Matters, as my guests and I bring some of the world's most compelling stories home to you.
Do you feel good about where we're heading with AI?
Maybe we need to invent a new word here, which kind of is a combination of frightened and excited.
I'm
excited.
So what are you waiting for?
For the world next week, the president's inbox.
And Why It Matters. We'll see you soon.
Today on The World, Israel has secured its borders with Gaza, but in Israeli towns invaded by Hamas over the weekend, the human toll is grim.
We saw lots of bodies, lots of burned houses, burned vehicles. So this is one village, but there are another 10 more communities.
Meantime, Hamas and Israel are exchanging missile fire. Residents in Gaza are preparing for a siege by Israel, but have nowhere to go.
People are still under the rubble till this moment. We all have this feeling that we won't make it till tomorrow.
I'm Marco Werman. A war between Israel and Hamas. We look at the impact there and beyond. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being here. We have a lot to get to today in the war between Israel and Hamas. President Biden spoke this afternoon. We'll hear his comments and the reaction of other world leaders just ahead. But we begin in southern Israel. Reporter Fuad Abu-Ghosh has been speaking with Israelis who are recovering from the invasion by Hamas and steeling themselves for what's next. Fuad spoke with us earlier today from near Ashkelon, Israel.
I'm at the junction of Zikim in southern Israel. I'm about 5 minutes away drive from the city of Ashkelon and 5 minutes away drive from the entry to Gaza. What I see right now in front of me in a huge farm field, tens of tanks with lots of bulldozers standing by, many media members lining up here and reporting to the world. In fact, right before you called me, within 3 minutes, rockets were fired from Gaza and they were intercepted immediately by the Iron Dome system right above us. The situation is really tough. Every once in a while, we see local residents coming to find out exactly who we are reporting for. Are we with Israel? Are we against Israel? And the situation for the reporters here is it's not easy because you have to look after yourself from the hostile environment, from the rockets and the shooting. And the second concern is that you have to look after yourself from the people. There is a lot of anger and frustration because of what happened on Saturday morning.
Was Ashkelon, where you are, Fuad, was it struck, in fact, this morning by shells from Gaza?
Yes, Ashkelon was struck twice today. And after the shelling, we saw a lot of smoke coming from there.
Can you just walk us through, Fuad, what the Israeli military is doing and what it's preparing to do in the next few days?
It's hard to guess what exactly. Some people, some news media saying there are preparation for a ground invasion. What I can see on the ground here are lots of tanks. This morning on my way to this location, every military base I passed by, I saw hundreds of cars. People basically volunteer. They are reserved. They drive up to the base. They leave. They park their car. They put on their uniform and join the units. In fact, the hotel where I'm staying, half of the staff been called for reserve to volunteer to get ready for a ground invasion and for basically a big war.
Well, speaking of military volunteers, Israel has called up more than 300,000 military reservists. I mean, that's a number that could potentially affect nearly every family in Israel. What are people saying about this mobilization?
This is really tough. This operation have united all the Israelis at this time. The main goal is to get their dignity back and to release the hostages. Of course, No one have published any plan, any idea what is the next step. But for the time being, you know, it's been a retaliation. Like where I'm standing right now, I can see smoke, heavy, dark smoke coming out of Gaza. Everywhere I look south, I see heavy smoke coming. So what I hear, like, you know, the Israeli army been really shelling all the day, the jets, the Iron Dome system, you know, they've been shelling for the fourth day in consistently.
Well, you've been speaking with Israelis today, Fuad. What are people most eager to tell you? What do they want to say?
They are shocked. I talked to a mother who lost her son. Her son was kidnapped into Gaza. Apparently, it was a party in the desert near Gaza. Approximately 5,000 people, young Israelis, attended this party. This mom is desperate to know what is happening to her son. He was at the party with his girlfriend. His girlfriend managed to survive because they ran into this bunker that was set up for soldiers near to the border. And they were the first people to get into the bunker. And then tens followed them. And after that, the Hamas militants were shooting and all the dead bodies were falling on top of them. And this is basically what saved the life of this girl, who is she also 27 years old. Managed to survive to tell the story and to see, to witness how her boyfriend was dragged from the pile of dead bodies away with the militants to Hamas.
Yeah, it's really extraordinary and really frightening. The Israeli hostages currently being held in Gaza, is anything known about what, if any, plans the Israeli government has to get them back?
This is the $1 million question people are looking for. This is the answer. No one knows the answer yet. There are different suggestions from different politicians, but the majority wants these captured people to get out, to be released alive and safe. How? No one knows. There is a lots of international interest. There is a lots of NGOs involved. This particular family that I talked to, they told me they made contact with the Red Cross and nothing happened beyond that. There is a committee of the parents who have lost or believe that their loved one been kidnapped to Gaza. This committee is dealing and fighting on their behalf to find out exactly what's the next step the government should do.
As far as the imminent siege on Gaza by Israel's military, we've heard about evacuations from Israeli villages near the Gaza Strip, mining that border area. What can you tell us about those measures and the intended impact?
Until this moment, we are prevented to reach these towns, these communities, and we've been hearing more and more from local media. Every once in a while, there are clashes between Israeli army and Hamas militants in these communities. So there is no clear and final decision to the situation right now. We know for sure that Kfar Aza was totally evacuated today. They evacuated a lot of bodies from there by the army. And we saw a lot of bodies, a lot of burned houses, burned vehicles. So this is one village. But there are another 10 more communities that are blocked and no one can go in.
Right. Well, you are wrapping up now an intense day of reporting. What goes through your mind, Fuad, as you put this day behind you?
It's really, really hard to predict what's going to happen. This is unprecedented operation. I never seen something like this in this region, like the number of casualties, the number of deaths on both sides. But the nature of this operation, the surprise, the way it was operated. My biggest fear is this hatred will spread inside Israel or to the West Bank, because this could happen. This could exactly repeat itself to what happened back in 2021, where you have clashes between citizens in mixed city. And this is my biggest fear, that the conflict will move into inside Israel.
Reporter Fuad Abu Ghosh has been speaking with us from the city of Ashkelon in southern Israel. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us this hour for the perspective of a resident in Gaza. That's still ahead. Meanwhile, at the White House this afternoon, President Joe Biden condemned the attack on Israel and expressed full-throated support for a U.S. key ally.
We stand with Israel. We stand with Israel.
Biden said the White House has been in near constant communication with Israel and regional allies since the attack by Hamas. The U.S. has already sent to the region an aircraft carrier strike group, munitions, and military equipment. Biden also plans to send aid for Israel's air defense system.
We're surging additional military assistance, including ammunition, and interceptors to replenish Iron Dome. We're going to make sure that Israel does not run out of these critical assets to defend its cities and its citizens.
He went on to say his administration is consulting closely with Congress during the crisis.
When Congress returns, we're going to ask them to take urgent action to fund the national security requirements of our critical partners. This is not about party or politics. This is about the security of our world, the security of the United States of America.
Biden also mentioned that he's been speaking with European leaders about the crisis. Many of those leaders are also making public their reaction to the war. The Eiffel Tower in Paris was lit up with the Star of David last night in support of Israel. In Berlin, the Israeli flag was projected onto the Brandenburg Gate. And in London, the home of the British Prime Minister was also illuminated with the blue and white of Israel's flag. But as the World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports, there may be less unity than it appears.
Hundreds sang the Israeli national anthem outside 10 Downing Street in London yesterday. It was at a vigil in solidarity with Israel. People waved the country's flag and held up banners that read, "I stand with Israel." Rishi Sunak, the British Prime Minister, attended a special service for victims of the Hamas attacks at a synagogue in North London.
As the Prime Minister of this country, I am unequivocal. The people who support Hamas are fully responsible for this appalling attack. They are not militants. They are not freedom fighters. They are terrorists.
But across the city in West London, there was another gathering. Crowds of people carrying Palestinian flags congregated outside the Israeli embassy in Kensington. They set off flares. Their placards read, "Stop bombing Gaza" and "Free Palestine now." In Spain yesterday, there was a rally in Puerta del Sol, Madrid's main square. A government building was lit up in the colours of the Israeli flag, but the crowds shouted slogans supporting Palestinians. "From the river to the sea, Palestine will win," they chanted. Meanwhile, in the centre of Paris last night, thousands sang the French national anthem. And a solidarity march for Israel. The contradictory responses weren't just on the streets of Europe's capitals yesterday. They came from EU leaders too. On Saturday, Ursula von der Leyen, the EU Commission President, issued a statement condemning the Hamas attack. Israel, she said, had the right to defend itself in line with international law. But Ireland, Denmark and Luxembourg are reported to have asked her to water down the statement. Some nations, like Hungary, Austria and the Czech Republic, tend to be pro-Israel. Others, like Ireland, take a more pro-Palestinian stance. So the EU usually tries not to get involved. Which is why a statement by one EU commissioner yesterday caught many off guard. Hungarian lawmaker Oliver Varhelyi tweeted that all development aid from the EU to Palestinians is to be suspended immediately.
It was one of the most serious blunders in EU foreign policy, I think, over the last years.
This is Christina Kausch with the German Marshall Fund. Europe is one of the biggest contributors of financial aid to Palestinian territories. Last night, the EU Commission issued a statement saying payments are not being suspended, but said, quote, a review of the EU's assistance for Palestine would get underway. Some countries like Germany and Austria say they plan to halt development aid to the region temporarily. But Kausch says the EU is very unlikely to cut its funding to Palestinians.
They're paying the salaries of the employees, of the public sector employees. They are paying for socioeconomic programs. So basically, the stability of Palestine, of the Palestinian territories, depends on that money.
And Kausch says the EU may have another awkward dilemma on its hands. Just like the Eiffel Tower in Paris, the EU Commission is also lit up in the colours of the Israeli flag.
How does that flag on the EU building look if, in a week's time, Israel invades Gaza, and very likely with very high civilian casualties? I bet you then the flag is taken down. So they're taking a great risk.
Today, EU foreign ministers were meeting in Oman. On the agenda, the issue of aid to Palestinians. but maybe in a sign that the EU is trying to revert to a more neutral stand, both the Israeli foreign minister and his counterpart in the Palestinian Authority have been invited to attend. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Also this weekend, a major earthquake in Afghanistan. That and more global news just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. We're learning more details about the impact from a series of earthquakes in Afghanistan over the past few days. They first shook the western province of Herat on Saturday morning and killed more than 2,000 people. A powerful 6.3 magnitude quake flattened entire villages, trapping people underneath their mud brick homes. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
The scene at the epicenter of the quake is one of total devastation. Zainab Khan Sepehri is a local reporter, and she had just returned to Herat city when I reached her over WhatsApp this morning. She says the situation in the Zandijan district is much worse than what is reported in international media. Not a single house is standing, she tells me. And if there is any structure still standing, people are too afraid to go inside. There have been several aftershocks since Saturday. Videos posted online showed residents digging through the rubble with their bare hands and shovels. This doctor at one of the clinics described the chaotic situation. He says people continue to bring the injured to the hospital for treatment from Herat city, but also from nearby villages. Another man, wrapped in a blanket, counted the number of the dead in each household in his neighborhood. 2, 3, 4, even 10 or 12 people who died in one house, he says. Many victims are still trapped under the rubble, and there is no heavy machinery to get them out. Sepehri, the journalist, tells me that most of the victims are women and children. Because, she says, the men were out at work or had to travel to nearby Iran to look for jobs. The Taliban have banned women from working except in few sectors. Sepehri says she also noticed that the women who have survived are not receiving the help they need. Three days later, she says, many still don't have access to sanitary products. Outside help has been sluggish. Most international NGOs left Afghanistan 2 years ago after the withdrawal of U.S. forces. That has left Afghanistan's healthcare system, which relied heavily on foreign aid, under-resourced. Ahmed Kaduda is with the aid organization Save the Children in Kabul.
Unfortunately, we're seeing a decrease in international humanitarian assistance and a significant drop in the longer-term development assistance that's really required to prevent the most severe impacts of such natural disasters.
The most immediate need right now, he says, is to find shelter for people who have lost everything in the Zandijan district.
We're hearing reports of 100% of homes having been destroyed.
Herat province is a major farming region of Afghanistan. It's known for its grapes, raisins, saffron, and figs. Kududa says people here were already struggling because of a recent drought.
Many families have been forced to sell their livestock in order to subsist, and their basic income has dwindled over the past period because of their inability to farm and have their produce reach market.
So far, Pakistan and China have officially offered help. Pakistan's government said it was sending thousands of tents, blankets, hygiene kits, and ration bags. The United Nations has also dispatched ambulances and doctors. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Coming back to our top story today, the impact of war between Hamas and Israel has shaken the region and the globe. In Eastern Europe, there are questions about whether and how the conflict might affect the war in Ukraine. So far, responses to the fighting in the Middle East from Moscow and Kyiv have been starkly different. From Riga, Latvia, The World's Daniel Offman reports.
In Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov met yesterday with the head of the Arab League. In a joint press conference, Lavrov said that the Russian Federation condemns violence in any form and calls on everyone to speak strongly against any military action.
В этой связи не могу не упомянуть деструктивную политику Соединенных Штатов, которая...
However, Lavrov was also quick to take the opportunity to blame the United States. He referred to the destructive politics of the United States. He also said that Americans are trying to monopolize the mediation process between the Israelis and Palestinians, and implied that the U.S. was in part responsible for the current situation. Here's Nikolai Kazhanov, an associate professor at the Gulf Studies Center at Qatar University.
Russia is trying to use this conflict and the situation around it as a cheap way to project power. It's trying to exploit the situation for the Russian benefits by presenting itself as a force which is able to talk to all camps in this conflict.
According to Kazhanov, Russia has developed strong working relationships with players throughout the Middle East, and that includes Israeli and Palestinian stakeholders.
In other words, choosing sides in this conflict is not in Russia's interest.
Kazhanov says that historically, Russia tends to speak up in support of the Palestinian camp in order to shore up relations with Arab states. But it's a balancing act, where Russia also tries to keep up steady relations with Israel. However, some have accused Russia of benefiting from regional instability.
Some Russian officials are happy about the fact that now there is another conflict that's diverting attention from what Russia is doing on the battlefields in Ukraine.
But Kazhanov says that despite the sentiment, this opinion is only expressed on political talk shows or on social media and not through official channels.
The instability in general, it allows Russia to play the role of the mediator. It creates certain opportunities that are usually non-existent during the peaceful times. But at the same time, Russia is interested in low level or simmering instability, let's put me in this way.
And right now, the conflict has boiled over into complete upheaval. Kazhanov says this is when the Kremlin tends to change its position from instigator to positioning itself as a mediator and a partner for peace. Ukraine, on the other hand, has taken a completely different approach. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky expressed his full-fledged support for Israel, saying that Israel has every right to defend itself, to protect itself from terror. Ukraine's military also chimed in, amplifying Zelensky's message. In this ad, members of Ukraine's armed forces say this attack against Israel is a crime against the civilized world, and every life matters, both in Israel and in Ukraine. Ukraine's robust message of support for Israel comes despite Israel's cautious approach to supporting Ukraine. But Ukraine's goal here is to contrast its position with the Kremlin by fully condemning Hamas and unjustified violence wherever it takes place. For The World, Daniel Hoffman in Riga, Latvia.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. Hamas stunned the world with its attack on Israel over the weekend. One security analyst called it a complete shock.
If you were to ask me which intelligence service was this least likely to happen to, I would put the Israelis at the very top.
We continue with the latest on the war in the Middle East, and in lighter news, chefs get more indigenous dishes on the menu. Still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. A stream of rockets fired from Gaza today targeted Tel Aviv and nearby Ben-Gurion International Airport. Meanwhile, civilians inside Gaza are scrambling to find shelter from near nonstop bombardments originating from Israel. Louis Baudouin-Larman is in Gaza. He's a communication director for Doctors Without Borders, also known as MSF. He says doctors in Gaza are working around the clock, and many of those providing medical care have themselves lost relatives, friends, and their homes.
The problem is that nobody is safe in Gaza right now.
Baudouin-Larman says a key hospital in the north of Gaza was forced to close today.
Several airstrikes all around it essentially made it impossible for staff to access the hospital. So the explosion from the blast made some considerable damage on the hospital, so they decided to shut it down.
Hin Khoudary in Gaza City also finds herself in the midst of devastation. She's a longtime Gaza resident and works as a journalist there.
I have been hearing nonstop explosions in different areas, very close to my house, nowhere to escape, no safe space. And at the same time, I see hundreds of homes and residential buildings being bombed and flattened. My whole neighborhood is literally flattened, and this breaks my heart.
So there are a couple of things I want to ask you about there, Hind. But first, let me ask you about your own family and friends. Are they safe? What news do you have from them?
Well, my mom and brothers are not safe. Yesterday, my family was surrounded by dozens of explosions, and today I visited the house. It's a disaster. Sharpness are everywhere. It's dust. All I saw is glass. They don't even have the mental ability to clean what happened. And I didn't even have the ability to enter the street by car. So I had to walk the whole way because after the airstrikes, there was a lot of holes in the street. And this is not only my family. Thousands of families in Gaza are not connected to the outer world. The amount of places that have been bombed and the amount of buildings that have been flattened is massive in the north, in the south, and whole neighborhoods that have been flattened. We feel so helpless. We're not even able to help ourselves. We're not even able to help other people. It's crazy what's going on.
Now, the home you were describing a moment ago, the one that was flattened, was that your own home where you lived and where you slept?
My house was not flattened, but my grandmother's and my grandfather's house was flattened. My mother's aunt's house was flattened. My friend's house was flattened. My other friend's house was partially damaged. I saw one of my friends who was with me in school, and he was crying in the middle of the street. And he's like, can you imagine the amount of destruction? I also went to Al-Shifa Hospital today, and I saw how the paramedics and the doctors are not having any capabilities to treat all of the injuries.
Did you witness doctors and nurses trying to figure out whom to help first?
Of course. My cousin is one of the female doctors in the Gaza Strip, and she did not go home for 48 hours on the first 2 days because they didn't even have space for all these injuries, that they didn't even have like a place to put them. She was like, we don't have any space. We started treating those people on the floor without anything. We barely have medicine. We barely have medical equipment. We're talking at least 4,000 Palestinians have been injured in 4 days only. This is insane.
I mean, given these life-threatening limitations, what is the mood and thinking as a major Israeli siege on Gaza is thought to being prepared?
Yesterday, we saw this post by Afikai Adri'i. He's the Israeli spokesperson or something like that, asking people in Ar-Rimal to evacuate. All of these people evacuate, don't know where to go. They don't have any place to go, and they don't have any food. They don't have any, like, all I saw is people holding their pillows, holding their sleeping mats and with their pillows and covers, and that's it. Most of the people who I met today told me we had only a couple of seconds just to leave. And people are like, okay, they want to impose a blockade. We already have a blockade. Like, it's not something new. We have been witnessing a blockade for more than 17 years. This is not something new. Like, do you get my point?
Well, yeah. I mean, Israel has told Palestinians to evacuate, and there's nowhere to evacuate to.
Yeah, but like, we're an open air prison, and we have zero places to go. Zero. I swear. Like, for me, I evacuated in a hotel with international news agencies. And right now, I have a boat burning in front of my eyes because the Israeli airstrikes targeted the Palestinian seaport in the Gaza Strip. This is like the safest place in Gaza. What I saw in these 4 days is something I never imagined I would ever witness. This is like, we're all going to die. This is the end.
Given all of that, Hind, I'm wondering if you could share any more stories that you're hearing from your friends and family. I mean, I just can't imagine how they're getting by every minute of the day at this point.
One of my colleagues yesterday was reporting, and then suddenly he was reporting on a house that was bombed. And then he realized that it was his house. He came crying and he was like, thank God I evacuated my wife and my children. Everything is very scary right now. I don't know if I have any hope for this, but all we're doing is praying. It's terrifying. This is not the first time I witnessed such attack. I have been there in 2008, in 2014, in 2012. I have been there like all of my life. I was born and raised in Gaza, but something like that, I don't know. I never witnessed. We all have this feeling that we won't make it till tomorrow. And the fear is so big and we can't do anything about it.
Palestinian journalist Hind Khoudary is in Gaza City. Thank you very much for speaking with us and please stay safe.
Thank you for giving us a chance to speak and to give Palestinians voice.
A big question on a lot of minds today, especially Israelis, is how Hamas pulled off its attack. How could Israel, with its exceptional intelligence capabilities, miss what the militants were planning? Hamas's attack early Saturday morning was brazen. Hundreds of militants from Gaza breached the wall separating it from Israel, breaking through with bulldozers, killing hundreds of Israelis, and taking others hostage. This all seemed to come as a total surprise to authorities in Israel. Colin Clark is director of research at the Sufan Group, a global intelligence and security consultancy. Are the appearances here correct, Colin? Did Israel have absolutely no idea this attack was coming?
It certainly seems like it, which is really a major shock. I mean, if you were to ask me which intelligence service was this least likely to happen to, I would put the Israelis at the very top, if not the top. They're that renowned for their capabilities. So a complete shock, not only that it happened, but the magnitude and the scale of the attack and the lethality that resulted.
Right. And even basic stuff. This came a day after the 50th anniversary of the start of the Yom Kippur War, when Israel faced a surprise attack from a coalition of Arab countries. I mean, anniversaries are notorious red lights for intelligence agencies. So how could this be the case?
Absolutely agree. The symbolism there, there are so many indicators that something potentially could have been in the works. There's clearly a major breakdown on the Israeli side of the house. There's going to be a lot of people losing their jobs in the aftermath of this conflict. And there's very likely, almost certainly going to be some kind of national commission where they look to kind of place blame, point fingers, figure out exactly what happened and get to the root of the problem. And they need to fix this immediately.
So what is the range of intelligence apparatus that Israel has that it uses to monitor what's happening in Gaza?
Well, it's vast. I mean, they have human intelligence, which is, you know, traditional spies that are recruited. There's signals intelligence, which is electronic intercepts. There's drones and sensors. Israel has redundancy built in between Shin Bet and the Mossad. And, you know, at the end of the day, Gaza is not that big. 25 square miles by 4 square miles, a relatively contained place to monitor. I mean, it is densely populated, so that makes it a bit more difficult. But the Israelis, this is their backyard. They've run spy networks in these groups like Hamas, Palestine Islamic Jihad, for years. They also get help from regional intelligence services. So again, this is just utterly shocking that this could have happened to the Israelis. And as you mentioned, at the timing of the 50th anniversary of the Yom Kippur War.
As far as human intelligence in Gaza, I imagine that is a risky role to be taking and one that Hamas is not going to tolerate. How reliable is the human intelligence?
Well, I guess we're finding out that it's not as reliable as the Israelis thought. There could be double agents at work, so they could have had individuals feeding them false information. There's also a lot of speculation that Hamas has been aided by the Iranians in what we call OPSEC, or operational security. The Israelis are known to be world-class at kind of hacking into phones and even breaking really solid encryption. And so Hamas, instead of trying to go smart, may have gone quote-unquote dumb. Ditched cell phones, ditched any kind of electronic communication, and went back old school, you know, couriers, face-to-face meetings and such. And that could have been why the Israelis were unable to learn about this in advance.
Yeah, let me ask you about this, because we're hearing a lot of speculation. But do you think, Colin, that Hamas had help in planning this?
I'd say the way I describe Iran's relationship to Hamas is similar to what the U.S. Army calls mission command. So we train our soldiers, we equip them, but at the tactical level, we trust them to make the right decision, to seize opportunities. It's very cumbersome to run up any kind of operation all the way up the chain of command to, you know, the top general. And I think that's an analogy for the way that Iran and Hamas works. They understand that Hamas knows the terrain better than the Iranians do. And this, you know, seems to be bearing fruit, that model. They've replicated this in other places, in Iraq, in Yemen, in Lebanon, and elsewhere.
Given the scale of what Hamas militants carried out on Saturday, how long do you suppose it would have taken to plan such an attack?
I mean, something like this, it had to have taken months. I mean, you had individuals coming in on hang gliders. It was really a sophisticated and complex attack that had to have taken, I would guess, months, if not longer, for them to plan and prepare for.
What does Saturday's attack by Hamas reveal, Colin, about Hamas's capabilities that was not known before?
Well, clearly, I think, you know, the Israelis and probably large portions of the international community significantly underestimated Hamas. So partly this is about Hamas's capabilities, which have improved quite a bit from 2 years ago, the last time Israel and Hamas got into a skirmish. But it also shows that the Israelis were distracted politically and really suffered from the protests that have been taking place in the country. You know, Netanyahu's focus on trying to revamp the Supreme Court and the judiciary really drained resources from the Israelis. They've spoken out, including, you know, reservists and retired military officers, about how it was negatively impacting readiness, right? Which also could feed into why the Israelis were so slow to respond. They've also shifted resources away from Gaza to the West Bank to deal with Palestine Islamic Jihad. So it was really the perfect storm of a lot of factors that kind of lined up that led to this outcome.
And the fact that Israel's Iron Dome, a defensive air missile system, which intercepts air attacks, why was that not effective on Saturday?
I think the Israelis were just overwhelmed. I mean, think about it. It was the Sabbath. It was coming off of a major holiday. You know, they had been looking elsewhere. And so the fact that it was combined arms, so air, sea, land, there was just various vectors that Hamas was able to kind of push through on. And then once hostages started being captured, I think that really must have consumed Israeli military and intelligence and really kind of caused a panic in the upper reaches of the Israeli government of how to respond and what to do next.
Finally, Colin, the Hamas ground attack on Israel for now has been stymied, but Hamas still holds Israelis hostage. What kind of intelligence capabilities has Israel marshaled to find them?
It's going to be incredibly complex if the Israelis launch some kind of a ground invasion to go into Gaza to attempt to rescue these hostages. There is a massive subterranean tunnel network. They're likely divvying up hostages in twosies and threesies. I would imagine right now the Israelis are relying on regional intelligence services, also the United States and others, to get as much information as possible about these hostages before they decide what to do next.
Colin Clark is Director of Research at the Sufan Group. Thanks very much, Colin. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Indigenous cuisine has been in the U.S. for a very long time, but you probably have not seen bison pot roast or elk tacos on restaurant menus very often. Now a new wave of indigenous chefs is winning awards serving up these kinds of dishes. From KUNC in Colorado, reporter Emma Vandenhende has our story.
Chef Andrea Murdoch is busy in the kitchen. She's baking her light blue sugar cookies with the help of some volunteer chefs.
They're like blue. Yeah, they stay blue. It's awesome.
They do?
Yeah.
That color is made from Ute Mountain Ute cornmeal from southwest Colorado.
Blue cornmeal is something that's very specific to the Four Corners region of the U.S. Like, you will not find this easily out on the West Coast and on the East Coast.
And this isn't the first time she's used unique ingredients.
I source locally and indigenously to support those economies. Kroger doesn't need my money.
It all started when Murdoch expanded Four Directions Cuisine, her food business. She wanted to create South American cuisine. And through her research, she found that ingredients representative of the culture were pre-colonial, like rabbit, bison, or other foods that existed in the Americas before colonizers arrived.
I have this distinct privilege and honor to be able to take the teachings from others and translate that through menus.
Along with sourcing food from local and indigenous farmers, she forages around her for flowers and grasses, praying to the weather god Iapa for rain. As she cooks, she taps into what she calls her sixth sense, and connects with plants and animals that are seen as relatives in her culture.
There's an element of listening to the ingredients and understanding how you're going to honor them best.
Indigenous cuisine like Murdoch's has recently grown in popularity, with many restaurants opening in cities like Minneapolis and Seattle. And for the second year in a row, a native chef won a James Beard Award, almost like the Oscars for cooking. But it wasn't always this way, and there's still room to grow.
We find food from all over the world in our amazing cities, and very seldom do we find food of where we happen to be standing that represents the land and the indigenous communities and cultures.
That's Sean Sherman, head chef of Awamni in Minnesota, and a multi-James Beard Award winner.
And we should really be focused on what's the true food of North America, and you can't understand North American food unless you bring the indigenous perspective into it.
He says the absence of native restaurants resulted from many wrongdoings by the federal government. Bison were killed at alarming rates. Federal boarding schools stripped indigenous peoples of their culture, and forcing them onto resource-poor reservations put them in a systemic trap. He says they haven't had time to heal yet, let alone evolve.
The more you dig into it, the more inequality you see, and the more racist structures you can see that are still built into the system.
Murdoch wants to shed light on this through her cooking. She's made food for several fundraising dinners that focus on issues like missing and murdered Indigenous relatives or Indian boarding school trauma.
Like, yes, I'm a chef, but I'm using that platform to bring awareness to cultural issues.
For The World, I'm Emma Vandenhyde.
Imagine for a moment a huge fleet of fishing boats, thousands of them, often moving in large groups. They are in pursuit of squid colonies. The boats work at night and are equipped with super bright lights to attract squid from deep below. It's all part of China's drive to control more of the ocean, all while depleting fish stocks and perpetuating human rights abuses abroad. Ian Urbina is an investigative reporter for the nonprofit Outlaw Ocean. He spent 4 years looking into the Chinese squid fishing phenomenon. Ian, when you looked into these squidders, that's what these ships are called, what kind of impact on the oceans did you start to see?
Well, squid's a funny thing. It's climate resistant, and so many foodies have speculated that squid populations would increase with the warming seas, but actually they've decreased globally. And that's largely because of huge fleets like the industrial fleet that China has. But you also see a lot of damage of other sorts. So some of these vessels are jiggers, but some of them are trawlers, and trawlers drag big nets and they tear up the ocean floor and catch all sorts of non-target species. So those are really worrisome problems too.
Is there a way to know if these ships are fishing illegally, and how do they do it? How can you catch it?
It's tough to catch. Illegal fishing comes in different forms. Sometimes, most often, it entails ships going into other countries' waters where they don't have a permit. The big problem is that the vast majority of this fishing is happening on the high seas, so international waters, and that's a free-for-all out there for the most part. There's no police force out there, so even if there are rules about what can be done, there's no real enforcement, and therefore industrial fleets like this can do as they please.
And these ships, I kind of said they were working as a convoy. Are they working, in fact, as one unit?
Yes and no. They're clusters, right? So we went to four places on the planet to look into this: the sea border with North Korea, high seas near the Falkland Islands, high seas near the Galapagos Islands, and then the coast of West Africa. And when you go to these places, you see clusters of ships, often 200-300 ships in the bunch, and they sort of travel the planet over the course of a year, year and a half. And they are very synchronized. They get a lot of support, both financial subsidies from the Chinese government, but also intel, daily, monthly reports on where the squid are going and the like. Sometimes they have medical vessels with them. Sometimes they have security patrols. So they're getting support, and the clusters work together as a group, but globally, they don't.
Yeah, I mean, your reporting, Ian, we should underscore, is not just about what these ships are doing, but what's happening inside. Starting with the deckhands, who are they?
So pre-COVID, the Chinese distant water fishing fleet, so the fleet that's in foreign waters or high seas, was largely Indonesian. The crew, the officers are obviously always Chinese. Within the vessels, you see a bifurcation. The officers tend to be coastal, urban, pretty literate, pretty savvy, experienced. The crews tend to be rural, inland, non-fluent with this line of work. They don't know what they're getting themselves into most often.
And once they learn what that work is all about, are there attempts to leave the job?
You know, often it starts as a strike, a work stoppage.
hey, look, you know, you told us we were going to earn X salary. When we got on board, you then changed it up on us and said, we're not getting a base salary. We're getting a percentage of the tonnage pulled. And also all these deductions, we're paying for our water, our cigarettes, our rooming. And so our actual take home money is minimal and we're not happy about it. So there's a work stoppage, a strike. Then often that doesn't go well. It escalates to mutiny level violence. And then sometimes in some cases like Peru, there's an example we cited where the crew attempt to run the ship aground in foreign waters so as to seek asylum.
Wow. I mean, that speaks volumes, doesn't it? You write in detail, Ian, about these deckhands, and one illness they seem to suffer from a lot is beriberi. People of a certain age will remember that word. What causes it and what happens to these fisher people who get it?
It's a crazy thing. You know, you think that scurvy, you know, is of the Dickensian era, something bygone. In the case of beriberi, it's a lack of B1 vitamin or thiamine. Mm. And most places in the world have governments that have required pasta, ramen noodles, you know, instant noodles or white rice to be supplemented with B1. But China doesn't have that rule. And on fishing vessels, you have to stock your pantry with stuff that will keep. And so a lot of guys, a shocking number, are getting this horrific disease. The other thing that's insane about it is it's very slow moving. It's reversible. You put a guy on an IV drip with B1 in it, you can reverse beriberi within 24 hours. And we found a lot of guys getting it and a lot of them dying from it.
Are these problems that just afflict all global seafood?
Yes, because a lot of seafood is either coming from Chinese ships, but it's being processed in Chinese factories. And because we found forced labor on the ships and in the factories, there's a global problem here because China is the linchpin. It is the superpower of seafood.
Ian Urbina is an investigative reporter for the nonprofit project Outlaw Ocean. His story about China's armada of squid boats is in The New Yorker. Ian, thank you very much for sharing what you found.
Thanks for having me.
The New Zealand Symphony Orchestra is used to playing for large sold-out crowds in concert halls. Their most recent performance looked a bit different. The venue was a farm, and the audience, chickens. This original composition was produced exclusively for some very lucky chickens in Hawke's Bay on New Zealand's North Island. It's called Chook Symphony No. 1. Chook is another term for chicken down under. The musical work and the farm performance are part of an effort to highlight animal welfare and ethical farming and came out of a partnership between the orchestra and a local organic farm. Peter Biggs, the orchestra's CEO, told the New Zealand Herald that his team drew from global studies to learn what kind of instruments the flock liked the most.
Chickens respond to a particular type of music, which is baroque. So strings, oboe, bassoon, a harpsichord.
A 9-piece ensemble recently played the arrangement live on the farm. I don't know exactly how chickens express happiness or interest, but a video of the concert shows dozens of them crowding around the musicians during the performance. The farmers in charge say they'll continue to play a recording of the symphony in the chicken coops. And Big says he hopes farms around the world pick up on the idea as well.
Because I think everybody wants, whatever species you are, to have a good life.
Something I think we can all agree on. And that is our show today. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. We're online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe. Stay strong. Please join us again tomorrow.